wanted to share this clip from one of Peter Hitchens's lesser talked about books, The Rage Against God. In it, he's talking about his experiences living in the Soviet Union, where he was posted in the late 80s and the early 90s. One of the things that struck me listening to it is how life here in the UK and elsewhere in the West have become more like Soviet Russia rather than less like Soviet Russia in the time since he wrote this in 2010. The parallels are there to see. Now, obviously, things aren't as bad for us as they were in Soviet Russia. We still have a certain degree of comfort. But I think he's right to see the warning signs there just in many of the little everyday things of life. So I hope you enjoy this. And I also think it's important to remember just how terrible communism was, and to make every effort to ensure that it never comes here.
Everyone else in the cinema was weeping. The film being shown in a movie theatre in a northern suburb of Moscow was not a romance or a sentimental drama, but a documentary entitled We Can't Go On Living Like This. It had been released for distribution only after a fierce argument at the summit of the communist apparatus still very much in charge of the then Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. This was June 1990, when the Gorbachev Revolution was approaching its final crisis. Why were they crying? Because the film openly told the truth that they all knew but had never been able to discuss. I remember several scenes, the orderly queue of neatly dressed citizens, dissolving into a yelling riot when word came down that the vodka ration for that week had been cancelled. The hideous prisoners' faces grotesque from habitual evil being herded in sordid dungeons, the desolate cityscapes of concrete slabs under poisoned skies, the filthy yellow waste trickling from a crooked pipeline into a polluted sea, the excrement smeared, desecrated ruins of what had once been churches, the corruption, and the unending official lies. Soviet citizens all knew life was like this. They knew the daily drudgery of finding anything decent to eat. They knew all the sugar had disappeared from the shops because the official anti-alcohol campaign had impelled millions to make their own vodka in the bathtub. They knew that if they wanted anaesthetics at the dentist, or antibiotics at the hospital, or cooperation from their child's teacher, or a holiday by the sea, they would need to bribe someone to get them. Even in Moscow, the show city of the evil empire, they knew that they dwelt in the suburbs of hell, that in mile after mile of mass-produced housing, you would be hard put to find a single family untouched by divorce, that no mother reared her own children, that the schools taught lies, that secret government establishments leaked radiation into air and water. Fresh eggs were an event. No meant, how much will you pay me? Rats were commonplace and played merrily among the trash cans of apartment blocks and in the entrances of railway terminals. Windows were filthy as a matter of course. I never saw a clean one. While most struggled to survive, a secret elite enjoyed great privileges, special living spaces, special hospitals with Western drugs and equipment, special schools in which their children were well taught in English, special waiting rooms in stations and airports, and special lanes. One ran down the middle of the street on which I lived, along which the Politburo's giant armoured limousines roared at 90 miles an hour, shouldering aside anyone who dared get in the way. The elite had privileged access to good food, foreign travel and books, and the grovelling servility of the organs of the state, which oppressed the common people and extorted money from them. This society, promoted by its leaders as an egalitarian utopia, was in truth one of the most unequal societies on earth. The Soviet paradise. Thanks to the power of hard currency, I lived on the edges of this elite for more than 2 years. My apartment, officially a typical workers' quarters, was in reality unavailable to anyone bereft of power or influence. It possessed 12-foot ceilings, oak parquet floors, uplifting views of the Moscow River on one side, and the whole panorama of the city on the other. Its staircase did not stink of urine and cabbage as those of normal blocks did. My neighbours included the Brezhnev family and several senior KGB officials. It exuded power. One night shortly before the beginning of the first Gulf War, I'd been to a late press conference given by Tariq Aziz, then Saddam Hussein's foreign minister. Because of the midnight hour, I'd gone there in my car, a Volvo with special yellow license plates that marked me out as a foreign correspondent. I normally used the metro, hating the angry, ruthless Moscow traffic and the endless attempts of the Gayi traffic police to extort extra big bribes from the rich foreigner, claiming that I had jumped red lights or broken speed limits when I hadn't. That night, the Gayi cops tried to wave me down 200 yards from my building. I was doing nothing wrong, and I ignored them, which sometimes worked because they were lazy as well as corrupt. This time it didn't. Unusually diligent, they gave chase and followed me into the courtyard. They were angry and perhaps drunk. "Your papers," demanded the slovenly officer. I gave them to him. He tossed them into the slush at my feet, yelling, "How dare you drive past our checkpoint when ordered to stop? And what are you doing in here anyway?" He gestured in the general direction of the Brezhnev's vast apartment. He plainly thought I'd tried to hide from him and was preparing to demand an unusually large bribe, until I said quietly, "I live here." He stiffened and looked suddenly afraid. He picked up my papers. He looked again at my passport with its residence permit for that address. He stepped back, saluted smartly, mumbled an apology for bothering me, and drove away without another word. This sort of privilege was unavailable at home in England, where even members of the royal family were pulled in for speeding. Yet here I was, in a society devoted to equality, asserting real rank over an agent of the state. I saw only the very end of it. Others have described the Soviet paradise when it was at the midnight of its dark power, which was, interestingly, the time when it probably worked best. If you're going to have a command economy, then it will function most effectively if there's plenty of fear. By the time I arrived in the Soviet capital in the summer of 1990, there was a shortage of fear, to match the shortages of shoes, furniture, gasoline, cigarettes and beer. But fear was still there in the background. People knew that the old monster could still lash out and destroy. I saw it do so in Lithuania in January 1991, when it made a last frantic attempt to stop the independence movement and blew holes in several people's heads on a snowy, horrible night. I describe this episode more fully in my book, The Broken Compass. Later, the military claimed that those it had shot were victims of traffic accidents, an insulting lie that made the action even more wicked. Mistrust and surveillance. Such abuses were part of a huge apparatus of what I can only call inquisitive evil, a self-serving interest in the lives of others that made normal human trust very difficult. The eventual opening of many secret police files in the former East Germany revealed that tens of thousands of citizens had spied on friends and neighbours in return for official favours. This is now generally accepted by everyone as having been the case, but in Moscow when I was there we were only guessing at the extent of it. The German revelations confirmed the impression I had in Moscow that the communist state had made a serious effort to replace and supplant such forces as conscience and self-control. It had taken onto itself the responsibilities of God and of believers in God, but its commandments were very different from those of God. Even I, an insignificant Western reporter, attracted KGB attention before I had even arrived. A smart and attractive middle-aged woman who spoke perfect English made herself agreeable to me on the long train journey from Ostend in Belgium to Moscow, and hired herself to me as my assistant without trying very hard to conceal her real interest. This could be briefly summed up as, "Are you a spy?" After a few weeks, when it was quite clear that this was most unlikely, she abruptly disappeared, along with the driver and cleaner she'd also arranged for me. Years later, after communism had collapsed, she reappeared in my life, claiming that she'd vanished in order to care for her dying lover, a KGB agent. Even so, the KGB continued to keep an eye on me after she was gone. My car was rather obviously fitted with a microphone. The driving mirror fell from its socket the day after the device was installed. My phone periodically stopped working, and I had to go round to the exchange and hammer on the door until laughing girls, who knew what was going on, leaned out of a high window to tell me it would be working again by the time I was home, which was always the case. My travel outside the city was closely monitored, and even a picnic in the woods outside Moscow was a nightmare of permissions and documents, since those innocent birch forests were crammed with missiles I was not supposed to see. You never knew who might be informing on you. You learned not to mind. A harsh and dangerous life. Mistrust and surveillance were not the only things that quickly struck me as different about this society. Soviet life, I learned speedily enough, was incredibly harsh and often dangerous. My Russian acquaintances thought my wife and I were 10 years younger than we were. We thought they were 10 years older than they were. Life began with harshness, even for the married. The main form of family planning, in a society that had little room for big families, was abortion, legally unrestricted in the post-war USSR as the need for a vast conscript army receded. In 1990, there were 6.46 million abortions in the USSR and 4.85 million live births. Birth itself was an authoritarian ordeal, with the newborns snatched away from their mothers by scowling nurses in tall chef's hats, tightly wrapped like loaves, and denied breast or bottle until the set time came round. You could spot a maternity hospital by the strings hanging from the windows, bearing pathetic messages of love or need from wives to husbands. Those husbands were forbidden for days to visit their wives or babies, and instead lurked smoking glumly on the weedy grass beneath the windows, waiting for a chance to catch sight of them. Once the baby was home, married life quickly included the state as third parents, and salaries were carefully set so that it took two wages to pay for the basics of life. It was virtually unknown for any mother to stay at home to look after her children, who were placed very early in slovenly nurseries, where they rarely died of the neglect they received, but were even more rarely given anything resembling a Western mother's loving attention. For the average citizen, it was a life lived at a dismally low level, materially, ethically, and culturally. The Soviet Union may have been a great power, but it was a great power that had diverted its resources into the hands of the state, with only the ruling elite spared the resulting dismal privations. Even the few available consumer goods were a risk to their owners. The chief danger in all lives came from badly built Soviet TV sets, famous for their habit of exploding and setting fire to the apartment, usually killing several people. But there were also collapsing balconies. Russian friends would always tut noisily and urge me to come back inside if I ever dared step onto mine, and mysterious holes in the sidewalk into which the elderly might easily tumble and break bones. Children's playgrounds were obstacle courses of unreliable equipment, strewn with broken glass, plentifully equipped with jagged edges. Here we were, in the midst of real existing socialism. While tourists and distinguished visitors were taken to the ballet, ordinary male Muscovites, women wouldn't have dared go there, patronized beer bars so horrible that I could only wonder at the home life of those who used them. You took your own glass, usually a rinsed-out pickle jar, and a handful of brass coins worth a few pennies, along with some dried fish wrapped in old newspaper. You fed your coins into a vending machine, and pale, acid beer dribbled intermittently out of a slimy pipe into your jar. You then went to a high table, slurped your beer, which tasted roughly the way old locomotives smell, and crunched your fish, spitting the bones onto the floor. There was no conversation. The alternative was to share a bottle of vodka, which could not be resealed once opened, in the street, a choice of evening that often led to the insensible drinkers freezing to death by the road. Special patrols quartered Moscow on winter nights, rescuing such people rather roughly. Those who'd been awarded the Order of Lenin, a medal for major achievement, were allowed to go home afterwards. Others were stripped of their clothes, flung into cells, prosecuted, fined, and reported to their employers. I visited one of the special police stations that handled the drunks, and they showed me a dismal museum of the things Russians drank when they could not get vodka. Cheap Soviet aftershave, apparently, was bearable and intoxicating, if drunk through cotton waste. A sandwich of black bread and toothpaste was mildly alcoholic, if nothing else could be found. A popular and bitter jest told the story of a conversation in a drinker's home after the state announced a rise in the price of vodka. "Daddy," asks the child with hope in its heart, "will this mean you will drink less?" "No," replies the head of the household. "It means that you will eat less." Compared with this desperate squalor, the meanest British public house and the most sordid American bar are temples of civilization and intellectual conversation. A coarse and mannerless society. There were several other features of life in communist, atheist, humanist Moscow that impressed me, accustomed as I was to the ordered consideration, general culture, and good manners of a rich and stable Protestant Christian society. One was pointed out to me by a visiting descendant of exiles whose grandparents had fled the city in the days of Lenin. He had, even so, been brought up in his American home speaking pure, good, middle-class Russian, literary and elegant, that sounded, as he said, like bells. He told me how shocked he was to hear and read the coarse, ugly, slang-infested and bureaucratic tongue that was now spoken in the city, even by educated professional people, and featured in its newspapers and on public notice boards. It was, he said, plainly a dissent. I was taken aback by a curious aspect of the metro, Moscow's enormous, never-resting and often workaday underground railway. Many of my journeys took place on remote lines or on modern sections, quite without the ornate glamour of the stations the tourists see. Because of the ferocity of the winters, the entrances to the escalators were guarded by heavy, stiff swing doors that were supposed to keep some of the heat in. I noticed that nobody ever held these doors open for those behind. As the habit of holding doors open for others was ingrained in me, I tried to defy this trend. Far from being delighted or impressed by my attempted courtesy, my Russian fellow passengers looked at me suspiciously as if I were planning to play a trick on them. One even said in satirical tones, "You're obviously not a Russian." A similar collapse of manners could be seen when a trolley bus swung into the roadside to pick up passengers. I often used this means of transportation to get home or to voyage to the outer fringes of the capital. If you were well bundled up, it was reasonably easy to withstand the ruthless pushing, elbowing, and fury that erupted every time the creaking, steamed-up vehicle stopped and flapped its doors open. And this was a civilized European city, not Africa, but at such moments it was hard to see the difference apart from the temperature. It is absolutely true, I saw it many times. The traffic stopped dead when rain began to fall, as every driver fetched windshield wipers from their hiding place and leapt out to fit them to their holders. Any wipers left in place while the car was parked would be stolen as a matter of course. Petty theft of unsecured property was universal and universally accepted as normal. Yet, if you could penetrate into the small, warm world of a Russian kitchen where close friends and family gathered over smoked fish, black bread and vodka to talk long into the night, you found an intense, civilized and courteous society of immensely knowledgeable and well-educated people, quite capable of common decency once they were in a private society, controlled and known by themselves. It was not that they were coarse and mannerless themselves. It was that they lived in a coarse and mannerless world against which it was futile for the lone individual to fight. I came to the conclusion, and nothing has since shifted it, that enormous and intrusive totalitarian state power, especially combined with militant egalitarianism, is an enemy of civility, of consideration, and even of enlightened self-interest. I also concluded that a high moral standard cannot be reached or maintained, unless it's generally accepted and understood by an overwhelming number of people. I've since concluded that a hitherto Christian society that was de-Christianized would also face such problems, because I've seen public discourtesy and incivility spreading rapidly in my own country as Christianity is forgotten. The accelerating decline of civility in Britain, which struck me very hard when I returned there in 1995 after nearly 5 years in Russia and the USA, has several causes. The rapid vanishing of Christianity from public consciousness and life, as the last fully Christian generation ages and disappears, seems to me to be a major part of it. I do not think I would have been half so shocked by the squalor and rudeness of 1990 Moscow if I had not come from a country where Christian forbearance was still well established. If I had then been able to see the London of 2010, I would have been equally shocked.